Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Politics in the U.S. have become increasingly hostile and uncivil in the past, say scholars. Language often vilifies fellow citizens and lawmakers. But Americans overwhelmingly dislike the incivility and have expressed shame at its effect on policy debates. What are the effects of incivility and vilification in a democratic society? Do they have real effects on the public policy? Does it affect political participation or the psychology of the citizens? We're joined by three experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is author of Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy and Mediated Politics, Communication in the Future of Democracy. His upcoming book is Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Stephen Hayman is professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law. He is the author of Free Speech and Human Dignity and the editor of Hate Speech in the Constitution. Michael Wagner is professor of political science at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and he is the co-author of Political Behavior and Midterm Elections. He's also co-author of The Consequences of Political Vilification. Let's start with the old idea of deliberation. Michael Wagner, your literature review reminds us about the benefits of real deliberation on political issues and how all sides come out ahead. Give us the overview about what democratic deliberation offers when people communicate about their disagreements.
Democratic theorists have long extolled the need for quality debate and compromise among lawmakers. And so governance requires at least political elites to deliberate and work together in order to come to some kind of consensus. The question, of course, is what is the quality of that deliberation? And is there something about what happens when the quality of that deliberation changes that can affect basic democratic processes like compromise or support for compromise or the willingness for Americans to civically engage? And so with my co-authors, Beth Tice Morse and Donna Jean Mitchell, we think that there is. And we think that when rhetoric is particularly nasty, something we call vilification, it affects people's willingness to compromise, both in terms of individual citizens' willingness to accept compromise and possibly even lawmakers' willingness to compromise across partisan lines. And so that's kind of where we begin our analysis.
Is that just an ideal that we have never had? Robert Entman.
Well, it may well be that our image of the past tends to be golden and unrealistic. So I'm not sure for how many generations we had what we would now call civil as opposed to uncivil discourse. But I would say that probably the era that much of political science and democratic theory is based in is the 50s and 60s, and that was a time when there was a different tone in Washington, but not just a different tone, a respect for certain rules of the game, which includes pretty much telling the truth, pretty much actually desiring to solve policy problems, and those are two things that have gone by the wayside.
So you would say that it has deteriorated, it has become more uncivil, and it's not something that historically has always been there.
Correct.
Steve Hayman?
There's a deep ambivalence in our First Amendment on the subject that you're asking about. There's a very strong theme in the Supreme Court's decisions about the First Amendment protecting a meaningful dialogue of ideas, a give and take between citizens where each of us has the right and the duty to express our own views, to listen to the views of other people, to try to understand where they're coming from. So that's one central image of the First Amendment. But at the same time, there's also sort of a different view that the First Amendment is meant to protect speech that may be abrasive, that may be sharply critical of public officials or of other groups within the society, and that the First Amendment almost exists to protect offensive speech because it is uncivil or because it challenges existing conventions.
I definitely want to get into the legal issues a little bit more nuance in a bit. Perhaps we should discuss the concepts of what it means to have incivility. Bob Entman, you said there are two kinds of incivility. What do you mean?
The kind of incivility we always talk about tends to be the impoliteness and kind of nasty rhetoric and personal insult. And that's important, and it's troubling when we have that kind of incivility. But the Oxford English Dictionary has a second definition, and I think that's actually our bigger problem now. And the second definition is orderly state of a country, social order as distinct from anarchy and disorder. And what I believe is that not that we're in a state of anarchy, but we're in a state in which we have disordered politics and disordered governance. And that's the real problem. And it comes down to the tendency of certain political actors to disregard what had been a longstanding norm of telling the truth and not deliberately making things up and sticking to those points if they win you political power.
You, an
example, climate change.
You talked about this, that this was a party strategy to keep winning. Can you explain how you find this strategy and what the reaction has been from the other party?
The strategy is actually to create this disorder and to create bad governance, because that's a way to discourage people from believing that government can solve problems and to encourage them to support so-called smaller government. And if you do that, in some senses, it doesn't really matter if that's your real goal, that is keeping power and shrinking the size of government and shrinking what government does, then it doesn't really matter what you're saying specifically, because that's the simple goal and that's the simple target. And from the point of view of the other party, it becomes very difficult to conduct a civilized dialogue from either side if one of the sides is really refusing to acknowledge some facts that most everyone who is intellectually honest would agree are indeed factual. So, you know, my main point is that we really have to name this problem more carefully. And it is a problem of the Republican Party having decided on this strategy, having moved sharply to the right, the Democratic Party trying to induce compromise on the part of the Republicans, and the Republicans responding by really not having any incentive or inclination to compromise in the interest of solving the problem. The real interest is shrinking the government and actually maintaining and expanding their power. That's an unfortunate thing. I know it sounds like I'm being partisan when I identify the problem as that, but I believe that's where we are, and I believe it's important to name the problem as it is so we can maybe do something about it.
This is one form of incivility. Michael Wagner takes a specific... Michael Wagner, you study political vilification of the other side. How do you distinguish the vilification from these other kinds of incivility?
I think Bob did a good job defining the kind of incivility that he wishes we would focus less on when he was describing, you know, kind of impoliteness, name-calling, derision of the opponent, those sorts of things, as being something that's uncivil with respect to discourse in American politics. Incivility has some effects on how people respond to political debate when they see it amongst political elites. What my colleagues and I want to argue is that there's something that we call vilification, which we make the argument that that's different than incivility. And so our argument is that incivility comprises name-calling, derision of the opponent, you know, impoliteness, things of that nature. And vilification calls the other side evil, malevolent, ungenuine, bent on destroying the country. So they ascribe a particular motive. It's not just that the other side are jerks. It's not just that the other side won't agree on the facts. It's that they're evil. It's that they're dangerous. And our argument is that when people are exposed to that kind of rhetoric, it makes some people way less likely to want to compromise, and it makes others way more likely to want to compromise. And much in the way that Bob makes the argument that the Republican Party has adopted a particular strategy, we make the argument that Republicans and Democrats in the electorate respond differently to vilification. So when Republicans see their party vilified, we find that they know who the enemy is, and there's no way they're going to compromise with them. If they come out and call us evil and dangerous, we're never going to make a political agreement with those folks, and we wouldn't support our leaders if they did. We find that Democrats in the electorate, when they see their party vilified, when they see their party called evil and dangerous, they become much more supportive of compromise. They want the fighting to stop. They want to come to some kind of solution as compared to keeping the attacks going. And so this has real implications for how governance works, because if you were the Democratic Party, you might not get much purchase out of attacking the other side in this particular way, because it's going to entrench your opponents and it's going to make your side want to compromise. And so, you know, there's some linkages, I think, with what Bob is talking about in terms of why the politics of today are the way that they are. What we don't know is how this has really varied over time. And so that's something that we're trying to investigate. That takes a really long time. And so I can't speak to whether the language is specifically worse now than it used to be, but I think our data does suggest that people in the electorate respond differently to vilifying attacks, and they don't respond that way just when the attacks are uncivil or when the facts or when the attacks are based on factual disputes. People don't have those same reactions in terms of their support of compromise or supporting other kinds of democratic principles.
I think I want to quickly talk about one more layer. There's one more level of this incivility vilification, and that is hate speech and harmful speech that is actually a legal issue. And Steve Hayman, this is where we bring you in. What distinguishes harmful speech and hate speech from other kinds of political speech?
You could view hate speech as being the most extreme form of the kind of speech that Bob and Mike were just talking about. That is, if you go one step even beyond vilification, beyond accusing your political opponents of being evil, if you go so far as to actually dehumanize them, to treat them as though they were subhuman, as though they're not entitled to the respect that you would give to other human beings or citizens, and in particular, if you abuse and degrade other people on the basis of their race or their ethnicity or their religion or their gender or their sexual orientation, that's what I would regard as being hate speech.
What if they were degraded with regards to their political ideology? Now, so far, we don't have that as a legal category. But one of the things that we have seen change in American discourse as the ultra-right airwaves have emerged is that liberals have been called all of these kind of dehumanized names. But we haven't seen that emerge yet in the legal world.
That's right. And I think the reason for that is that the Supreme Court regards the right to sharply disagree about political issues to be right at the core of the First Amendment. And so to the extent that people are attacking other members of the polity on the basis of their political views, I think the tendency is more to view that as being a vigorous or sharp political disagreement rather than an actual denigration of the very humanity of the people that you're disagreeing with.
Some of the dialogue does get to the level of calling liberals a scourge of society. How does that comport?
I agree with you that it's possible for political rhetoric to become so extreme as to amount to a sort of hate speech against your political opponents. And I think that we need to try to avoid that to the greatest extent possible and to condemn it when people do engage in that kind of speech. I should add that existing First Amendment jurisprudence treats even racist hate speech as generally being protected by the First Amendment. All the more so, I think, the court would regard the kind of political hate speech that you're talking about as protected.
So there's a wide range of potential consequences. Robert Entman, you pointed out that there are some serious policy implications. One you mentioned was climate change. Another is how Obama approached the war out of his fear of being attacked.
This very much goes along with what Michael was talking about, in that it is rational for Obama to anticipate that if he were to make any move such as, for example, sharply de-escalating the war in Afghanistan, any move that would put him up to the charge of being unpatriotic or soft on defense, that the Republican Party would take that opening and run with it, and it would actually go along with the frame that they've already been pushing about he wasn't really born in the United States and he's a socialist and he's an anti-colonialist and so forth. And I believe that there's substantial evidence, for example, in Bob Woodward's book about Obama's war, that the reason we are still in Afghanistan, the reason we have not curtailed and brought that to a close the way we are doing apparently in Iraq, is because of that fear that we're in Afghanistan because of the kinds of incivility that we're talking about right now.
The climate change issue you started to talk about, media have had a profound impact on this. Bob Entman?
In the case of climate change, you have a situation now where all but one of the Republican candidates for the United States Senate in 2010 denied that climate change is a problem, and that one doesn't want to do anything about it. So we're talking about a situation not contemplated by democratic theory, as far as I know, at least in the American context, and that is where one party, for whatever reasons, is unified around something clearly not factual, and clearly there is climate change, and no reputable scientists dispute that to any substantial degree. And if you have that situation, you have a paralyzed policy process, because our particular political process is one that gives minorities, like such as the Republican minority in the Senate, an opportunity to veto pretty much anything that they don't like. And that's what's happened here. So think about this. We really haven't had much in the way of any discussion at all about climate change during the Obama administration. There was a little bit around the Copenhagen conference, but that's it. And this is a huge issue facing the whole world. So now we're talking about our incivility actually affecting not just America, but the globe.
And there was an additional incivility, which was after they hacked into the scientists' email accounts, they really vilified the scientists, which turned a lot of the public against science itself. At least the polls have shown that.
I think that's right, and I think that that can have a chilling effect on how scientists think about reporting their results, which is something that we ought to worry about, I think, as a democratic society. For example, thinking about climate change, another reason that this kind of rhetoric is allowed to exist is because in this particular role, the news media don't tend to act as an appropriate watchdog, which is to say, it's kind of an accepted practice in journalism, regardless of whether a story has 1, 2, or 12 sides, to report two sides of a story. And so scientist X says that there's climate change, scientist Y says that there isn't, you decide, and if I report a story that way, then you can't call me biased. If I report almost all scientists who study weather and geography and climate and any variety of those sorts of things conclude that climate change is occurring, that it's accelerated since humans have developed particular technologies, and a couple of folks say that it hasn't occurred, then they open themselves up to charges of being biased, while at the same time would open themselves up to charges of telling the precise truth. But since reporters don't like to adjudicate between competing opinions, it's difficult to disabuse people of beliefs that they have that are false. I think that's all tied up into the style of rhetoric that we've been discussing.
Media have become very bifurcated, where you still have the media that try to do this objective, in quotes, reporting with two sides. But we've also seen this emergence of very one-sided, vilifying kind of media that has added to all of this. Canada and other countries have some restrictions on lying on the air. How is this addressed, and how should it be addressed?
The American Supreme Court has taken a much more absolutist approach to the protection of freedom of speech than many other liberal democratic countries do. And that's true with regard to hate speech, and also true with regard to defamation and, as you said, other forms of lying on the air. And I think that in part it's simply because the First Amendment sounds more absolutist than the corresponding protections for freedom of expression in many other countries. In many other countries, there are explicit constitutional provisions that say that all of the rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution are subject to such limits as are justified in a democratic society. And in general, there's much more of a tendency in these other legal systems to strike a balance between freedom of expression on one hand and other strong public values on the other side.
One of your papers argues that there are other competing rights, rights of citizenship, rights of intellectual freedom, rights of equality, that actually clash with this kind of public discourse. How would you express these nuances?
Particularly in the case of the racist hate speech that we had touched on before, that while I have a right to freedom of speech, that right is grounded in a respect for human dignity and autonomy, and that those same values give rise to other kinds of rights. A right to be free from violence, a right to citizenship and equality and reputation and so forth. In fact, if you go back to the original understanding of the First Amendment, the view was that the right to free speech was an inherent natural right, but it was limited by the rights of other people. I think that the modern Supreme Court has very much lost sight of that view, but that it would very much improve our First Amendment jurisprudence, and then maybe in turn improve the quality of our public discourse, if we would go back to a view that sees free speech as limited by the rights of other people.
Here's an irony, if I may say, in that the uncivil politics of Supreme Court nominations directly affects the ability of the Supreme Court, or let's say the inclination of the Supreme Court, to take a more nuanced view of the First Amendment. So we used to have a view on the Supreme Court that was a more balanced one between rights of free speech and rights of citizens and so forth. And that view has been pushed aside to a small minority now, and an absolutist version of the First Amendment ensconced. precisely because the Republican Party absolutely refuses to consider liberal justices. So all we've had is very conservative justices nominated by Republican presidents and very moderate centrist justices nominated by Democratic presidents, because those are the only ones that Republicans would allow to go through. So I think it's really important for listeners to understand that the First Amendment has, the meaning of it has changed in practice over time, and that's very much dependent on the identity of the Supreme Court. And because the parties are so polarized, and in particular the Republican Party is so determined to hold on to power, that it actually affects the way the First Amendment operates in our country at any given time.
Steve Heyman, would you like to add to that?
It has changed. And one very interesting and dramatic change that's taken place over the past 30 or 40 years is that freedom of speech, which used to be primarily viewed as a liberal or a progressive value, has come to be appropriated by the right. So it is now conservatives who tend to be much more absolutist, at least within the Supreme Court, on First Amendment issues than the liberals do. And I think there's a view on the part of the conservative justices that any sort of even reasonable or moderate restrictions on hate speech or on corporate speech is some sort of an effort on the part of the left to suppress conservatives. So that helps to explain why it's the conservatives who have been most absolutist in the protection of hate speech and the conservatives who were responsible for the Citizens United decision.
Michael Wagner, let's bring you back in.
It occurs to me that we see some of these same principles and same, I guess not really principles, tendencies coming into other elements of our politics. And so Bob had made an argument that Republicans nominate extreme Supreme Court justices and Democrats nominate moderate ones. And if we look at the results of the 2010 congressional elections, we find something similar in that there's good evidence that the Republicans who won office for the first time in 2010 are more conservative than the Republicans who were already in office. The Democrats who won office for the first time in 2010 were more conservative than the Democrats who were already in office. And so Democrats who won were ideologically to the right of the Democrats in Congress, just as Republicans who won were ideologically to the right of the Republicans in Congress. And so there seems to be an acceptance amongst candidates for office about who they want to appeal to and how they want to appeal to them. And that, you know, is all wrapped up in the civility of our discourse, how people respond to that kind of rhetoric, how the media report that kind of rhetoric, and how courts allow or don't allow it. And so I think it all telling a similar story, which I think is something for us to really think about.
Where could this go from here into a more civilized discourse? Bob Entman, what are your thoughts? How do we move into more constructive dialogue?
That's an enormously important question. It may sound hard to believe, but it seems to me that we're reaching a point in this country where we need to start thinking of ourselves as having a form of civil conflict. It's not of civil war, but a lot of similarities between now and the pre-Civil War United States of the 1850s are going on. And we do know a lot more, I think, than we did then about how to bring groups that are unalterably opposed together and actually try to gain some common ground on the basis of mutual respect and understanding. So I would propose that we actually have a series of conferences where the two sides sit down, and maybe they're not just politicians, but there are other people like professors, for example, in the room, and try to hammer this out in a way that recognizes that this is a little bit verging on going towards just the edge of a situation like Northern Ireland, or we could name many other civil conflicts. So we really need to take it very seriously. I do think that there's a little tendency on the part of Republicans in particular to see this kind of as a game. And at some point, this game becomes pretty dangerous. And that's why I think we ought to name this problem and take it seriously and really try to get both parties to understand that ultimately the stakes are the history, the future of our country and our children. And we really need to step back from where we've been lately.
Steve Heyman.
I would love to see the sort of effort to develop common ground that Bob was just talking about. I may be a little more pessimistic about the ability to do that. My sense is that a lot of the source of the incivility in our current politics comes from the refusal of a certain group of white conservative Americans to accept the very legitimacy of people who aren't like them, racial minorities, Barack Obama being the most prominent example, and that a lot of the incivility in the last years has resulted from just a very powerful backlash against the very idea of having somebody like that in the White House, which goes along with the sort of vilification of liberals that we've been talking about. And Obama has done everything that he can to try to develop that kind of common ground and civil discourse, and it really hasn't succeeded. So I guess my sense is that the first thing that we may have to do is actually to be a little bit more uncivil on the left, in the sense of coming out and very strongly condemning the kind of rejectionist, condemnatory views that we sometimes hear from the right, and that ultimately the best hope for establishing some kind of broader civility is when people who don't fall within the demographic that the Republican Party is appealing to can actually assert enough majority control over the society. The white conservative group recognizes itself as being part of a multicultural and pluralistic and ideologically diverse country, rather than taking the view that their country is being stolen from them and that they essentially do need to start a civil war against their opponent.
I think a couple things are going on here, and I think one is that, as Stephen talked a lot about what elites can do, I think just thinking about the public, one thing that's important to realize is that people are different. Individuals vary, and they do so systematically and in some cases intractably. And so to know that some people, honest to goodness, no matter what you tell them, believe that smaller government is good, and others believe that a more activist government is good, you know, these folks are not likely to change their views on that in a lot of cases. And so it's one way we can promote tolerance is to accept that people do have different views. And one problem with the American people is they drastically overestimate the degree to which people agree with them. And there's actually quite a bit of ideological diversity in the United States. And so I think recognizing that and promoting those differences would go some way toward improving tolerance, which I think could help the problem of uncivility. The second thing is that some recent research from a guy named Brendan Nyhan suggests that a great strategy at the elite level and at the public level to get people to believe things that are true when they don't want to is a strategy of naming and shaming. And so when President Obama said in the recent State of the Union, if you say things that aren't true about this policy, I'm going to call you out, that's the right strategy. He just hasn't done it. So political leaders need, and the news media need to say, you know, this person said something, it was not true. And every time they say it, they need to say it was not true. And so we need more things like PolitiFact, which won a Pulitzer Prize for, you know, kind of rating the truthfulness of what it is our lawmakers say. And, you know, while PolitiFact is an imperfect tool, it's the kind of tool that I think can promote the other kind of incivility that Bob was talking about at the top of our program, that, you know, the right to accept things that are true when they're true and the ability to believe them as fact and to stop rejecting facts for ideological reasons rather than empirically scientific ones.
That's a great place to end. Thank you also very much, Robert Entman, Professor of Media and Public Affairs and International Affairs at George Washington University, author of Projections of Power and Mediated Politics, Stephen Hyman, Professor of Law at Chicago Kent College of Law, author of Free Speech and Human Dignity and Hate Speech in the Constitution, Michael Wagner, Professor of Political Science at University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and co-author of Political Behavior in Midterm Elections and the Consequences of Political Vilification. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.